Today, we are on the second part of our series on personal vehicle dependency in the North. I have Cassidy Shuvera with me to discuss how women's safety is affected by the lack of accessibility that we're facing in parts of northern BC. Would you care to introduce yourself, Cassidy?
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, my name is Cassidy, and I use the pronoun she, her, and I am a white settler with French and Ukrainian ancestry. I am incredibly honored to work and live on the unceded and traditional territory of the Klaitlitsine. I work at Elizabeth Fry Society in Prince George as an outreach worker, working with women and children fleeing unsafe and or homeless situations. Just recently, I completed my master's in interdisciplinary studies at UNBC, and my thesis is entitled Issues of Accessibility in the North, an Analysis of Transportation in the Highway of Tears. So it looks at a timeline of the policy development of what's called the Highway 16 Transportation Action Plan, which sought to respond to safety and transportation gaps along the Highway 16 corridor in northern BC. So this includes looking at the first point in the development in 2006, which actually defined the problem of safety for women in the North and transportation at the Highway of Tears Symposium, and then going into the announcement of the actual policy itself in 2015 by the government in power. So I analyzed the current state of transportation accessibility, gaps and barriers in the North, and how it connects to concerns for safety for women in the North. And further to this, I examined how the Highway 16 Transportation Action Plan developed in order to understand why it took 10 years for a policy response to emerge that addressed safety concerns and transportation in the North. So that's a little bit about myself and my research.
Perfect. Thank you so much for sharing that. That is an incredibly important topic to delve into further. And so, based on your research and findings, what are some of the major issues you would say women face on a day-to-day basis when walking around cities and towns, especially at night?
Yeah, definitely. So I think when it comes to my research, I focus more on intraprovincial, so connecting communities and towns with the bus shuttle system. However, I think any woman can speak from experience in terms of the way that we have subconsciously been conditioned to involve active safety planning in our day-to-day routine. So this can look different for everyone, depending where you live, whether it's in a city or a rural community. For example, this can be things like holding on to our keys in our hand while we're walking out to our car, or making sure that we're parking our car next to a light post and not in dark areas. And sometimes it could even be asking a coworker to walk you to your car or sending a text check-in when you depart or arrive from a location. So I think while safety planning is important and knowing the tips that I've mentioned can increase someone's safety, women are placed with this burden of safety planning when we should be able to feel safe as is. So it's things like these and more that we're constantly trying to address and trying to raise further awareness. And more specifically, we have the Take Back the Night March as well, too. So Take Back the Night PG is an event to honor the memory of women who have not survived violence, celebrate those who have, and to demand an end to all forms of violence against women. So it's an opportunity for us to kind of highlight the fact that we should be able to feel safe when we are walking around cities and towns, whether it's during the day or at night. However, we don't.
Would you be able to elaborate a bit more on the Take Back the Night event? How is that put together? Who coordinates it?
Yeah, definitely. So we actually have a Take Back the Night community organizing team that I'm actually honored to be a part of, and we have it every year. It's in September, and so we usually organize a march. However, this year, due to COVID, we couldn't do the march, so we did it all online. We actually have a Facebook page, Take Back the Night PG. So it's just an opportunity for us to, like I said, to remember those who have not survived violence, and also to raise awareness in terms of, you know, let's start this conversation and let's bring this conversation to our workplace, to home, in our communities, to see what we can do moving forward to make sure that we can walk alone and we can walk safely alone.
That is so great. That is so important to bring that conversation really to every table.
Absolutely.
And so, sort of delving into the barriers that are in place for women a bit more in depth, would mm-hmm. you say that there are certain systematic barriers in place for some women not being able to travel around as safely as others?
Absolutely. So I think I'll kind of look at this in two ways. So first, I'll look at it in terms of the transportation itself, and then I'll delve into more of the impacts on women. So I think when it comes to transportation, people ideally have the choice to access either their private, if it's a personal car, or public forms like bus routes. However, this choice can be impacted by economic power imbalances or social geographic characteristics. So for example, in my research, I look at the ways poverty impacts accessibility to transportation. So if someone cannot economically afford a car, gas money, or bus tickets, their access to transportation is greatly impacted. And this is an experience that is all too real within remote communities along Highway 16. In addition to this, if you do not have access to private modes of transportation, then you are dependent on public forms like bus routes. And in my research, the actual availability itself of these forms of transportation is limited, and that is a barrier for individuals who require transportation to access basic needs like groceries, healthcare services, or even having social connection. So moving more so in terms of the impacts on women, so if we're looking at socio-geographic characteristics, looking at it from a northern perspective, we have to take into account the great distances between communities, unpredictable weather conditions of the north, and the isolation from basic needs and services. So these factors impact anyone, but can greatly impact women who could be stuck in an abusive situation or in an unsafe situation in a remote community. So for example, if a woman is planning on leaving an unsafe situation, they would have to plan their escape around the availability of a bus route in the area. You know, what time and day does it run? Does it work when my abuser is not around? Are some questions that someone might ask. The limited transportation options may leave someone stuck then in this abusive situation with no hope of escaping. And then even in addition to this, if someone is not in an unsafe situation, the limited access to transportation is a barrier that forces individuals to hitchhike as a result, right? So therefore, safety can greatly impact any situation when there are limited to non-existent transportation options that exist.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Yeah, and so in regards to the concerns that would affect northern cities specifically, would mm-hmm. you say that Prince George is adequately designed to deal with these concerns? And yeah. if not, what changes, if any, do you believe should be made to further ensure the safety of women who have to walk or take public transportation, especially in the downtown areas?
Right. So I think I would argue that Prince George has the opportunity to be a leader in this area mm-hmm. to address these concerns. In Prince George and in the surrounding area, we are a center where women have and continue to go missing and have been found murdered. Prince George was the home of the Highway of Tears Symposium, which happened in 2006, which identified 33 recommendations for our governments to engage in to make change, and most importantly, to start that discussion on how we can make our communities a safe place to live. So in my thesis, I actually highlighted the resiliency of northern communities to have their voices heard, and I think that's exactly what we need. We need more local leaders to step up and to take northern issues and voices to higher levels of government so we can get that support in return. We also need northern leaders to engage in these conversations of safety for women in the north and identify what we can do at the local level. I also found in my research that partnerships are key, and that includes both horizontally at the local level, so looking between local leaders and organizations, and then also vertically between levels of government, including provincial, local, and Indigenous leaders as well too. So I would think that starting at the Highway of Tears Symposium and those 33 recommendations would be a great first step.
Mm-hmm, for sure. And so you've touched on hitchhiking a little bit and mm-hmm. The missing and murdered Indigenous women. Mm-hmm. Would you be able to elaborate on some of the major factors that have gone into the tragedies that have occurred on the Highway of Tears?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, as we know, over the past 45 years, Highway 16 or portion of Highway 16, which has become known as the Highway of Tears, due to the countless women and young girls who have gone missing or been found murdered, it's something that really marks our area, right? Mm-hmm. It's something that we're constantly discussing and trying to think of how can we do better, you know, moving forward to address this issue, as it's an issue that feels like it hasn't been truly responded to, mm-hmm. I would say. So when I initially approached my research, I was really set on the fact that, okay, transportation was one of the major factors that contributed to these tragedies. While limited to no access to transportation is an issue, there is also so much more behind the issue of transportation itself, including political and sociocultural factors. So going more into what I found in my research, I would say that so neoliberalism, it's a policy approach that looks at rolling back the state and rolling out private services. It looks at what should and should not be included as a government service, which often leads to services and funding being cut. So I argue that neoliberalism played a role in holding back the transportation development along the corridor. So even when we had Greyhound along the corridor there was offering services, a government with a neoliberal policy orientation is going to hold out and not create further competition in the market despite the need for a different kind of bus shuttle system in the area and despite the safety initiative and the demand for something new that works with communities. And northern communities were demanding this. Even when Greyhound was there, they were demanding a change, you know, an additional service to help fill in the gaps that still existed, right? Mm-hmm. So while northern communities identified this gap of transportation, they were powerless in the face of a government which was guided by a policy orientation focused more on private services other than government involvement. So I think this speaks further to another massive factor that contributes to the minimization of the tragedies that have occurred. So I would say colonialism, institutionalized racism, and sexism are also all major factors that fuel violence against women, but also are ingrained within our systems that make justice for women, but more specifically, Indigenous women, that much more difficult. So in my research, I go back to this author, Andrea Smith, and her book, Conquest, where she argues that Indigenous women do not experience the same response from the justice system compared to non-Indigenous when it comes to police investigations, because they are often blamed for putting themselves at risk, right? So I think the big thing here is that the issue is not that anyone is putting themselves at risk. It's the issue that Canada is facing a national crisis regarding the high rates of missing and murdered Indigenous women across the country. And it's an issue that there are high rates of poverty in the north and higher rates of poverty among Indigenous peoples. So kind of bringing that all together, I think the safety, sexism, racism, intergenerational trauma, and justice are still massive, unresolved factors in this whole puzzle of the Highway of Tears tragedies.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for bringing more light onto that situation. I think a lot of those details perhaps aren't necessarily known by a lot of our listeners.
Yeah.
And so that's very enlightening. It's definitely very sad, and it's true that it is a national crisis.
Absolutely.
In so many ways. And so all of that being said, do you believe that more accessible, readily available public transportation would positively impact the safety and well-being of women in the North in general?
So I think there's two answers to this question.
Mm-hmm.
So I think first, yes, more readily available public transportation options definitely have the potential to positively impact the safety and well-being of women in the North, because the experiences of isolation, poverty, limited access to basic needs that I mentioned in the North are all too real. And I think bridging them with stronger, affordable transportation networks that are unique to each area makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
However, kind of what I mentioned before, despite all the work we do to ensure there are safe and accessible options of transportation, the main problem still persists. And that problem is the fact that perpetrators of violence against women are allowed to commit acts of violence, and not that women are putting themselves at risk. I think it's the sexist and racist notions thriving in society that underline this violence and then make women, and more specifically Indigenous women, targets of this behavior, and that's not okay. So transportation, kind of what I said before, transportation is a symptom. It's a symptom of a greater problem of violence against women. And we can treat the symptoms by addressing them with policy solutions. But we also need to engage further in a conversation of, like you mentioned, the systematic barriers and issues that exist in our communities. So those conversations and hopefully the solutions generated from them will have a positive impact on the safety and well-being of women in the North.
Mm-hmm. For sure. I think it is a very compound issue, and I think it's important to look at it that way. And so what is some advice in general that you may have for women who want to rely less on personal vehicle usage but are concerned for their safety by doing so?
Yeah, definitely. That's a great question. That's a very hard question. I think when you think of it, we kind of have to find this balance of choice and safety, and we have to acknowledge that, I mean, we have the right and freedom to access transportation as anyone else. However, unfortunately, there is this burden, as I mentioned earlier, this burden and conscious awareness that we must engage in safety planning for ourselves to make sure that we do get from point A to point B safely. And with where we are in the world, we do have to recognize the importance of safety planning. And even if we don't consciously realize it, I think we could all find ways in which we are subconsciously always safety planning with ourselves when we are if going out somewhere alone, if we're going out at night alone, or different things like that. So I think I would always say checking in and out with loved ones and friends when you depart or arrive to a destination, maybe letting loved ones know which bus routes that you take and the different timings that they depart and arrive as well, too. Just everyone's situation is unique in terms of how they access transportation. So I think just reflecting with yourself in terms of how you can safety plan day to day and what you're comfortable with. But also, I hope that thinking about safety planning and having this conversation fuels us further to raise that discussion of, okay, what should we change in our world so we can feel safe without having to always actively engage in checking our surroundings, because we shouldn't have to do that. We should be able to go out and feel safe.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Thank you so much for sharing that advice. I think it is very important, and that definitely touches on a lot of the issues.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here today and doing this interview with us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And the couple different things that I've touched on, I hope people can kind of engage in that conversation further. Like I said, you know, if it's with friends or families at work in the community, and just kind of think of ways on how we can support each other and even encourage, like I said, our local leaders to engage in this conversation with us. Because, like I said, we have the right. We have the right to feel safe in our communities. But what can we be doing better to make it that way?
Absolutely. And do you have any other resources that you might like to bring up if people want to research this further?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think I'm a little bit biased maybe in terms of encouraging people to check out Take Back the Night PG and even the Take Back the Night Foundation. So we do have a Facebook page online, and then they can also Google the Take Back the Night Foundation as well, just to get a little bit more information about what they do, because it's worldwide, right? So they can definitely check that out. Other than that, I just encourage people to maybe connect with local organizations as well, too, to see what services or information they have to offer in terms of supporting in this process. So,
That's great. Thank you so much for sharing that. All right. Well, I think that's just about all the time that we have for today. But thank you again for being here and doing this interview.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.